Shoulder mobility, we talked last time about foam rolling for the hips in order to open up range of motion. This time we're going to talk about how to open up shoulder range of motion, what shoulder mobility actually means, where it comes from, and then comparing a big bang for your buck activity like a side lying step over on a roller for the hips. What's an analogy to that with the upper body and shoulder mobility? Mm-hmm. All of that on this week's episode of...
Welcome to Reconsider. I'm Bill Hartman. This is the podcast to challenge you to ask better questions, to look beyond traditional models of thinking, and arrive at better health and fitness solutions.
Well, the hip mobility episode was a big one.
Yeah.
Just in terms of viewership, as the AI gods foretold, the YouTube Skynet foretold.
Skynet, yes. We need to be concerned of the Terminators.
So last time, as a review, we talked about using a step over activity on a foam roller, which you, Bill actually wrote a little article about, which is on the UHP network. So UHP.network. Head over there. You can get on for free. There's a free version of the site. There is a 3-day free trial for anyone that wants to get onto the plus version, the premium subscription side. And that's where this article is. So you can you could read it for free if you want. So again, UHP.network for that. But we're talking about, we talked about the hip mobility stuff with the step over and that being the big bang for the buck thing. But let's start with shoulder mobility, where it comes from, some of the misconceptions about it, and then we'll talk about activities.
Well, mobility just means the capacity to access a shape and position, right?
Yeah. Well, so let's talk about acquiring range of motion and why people lose range of motion in the upper body.
Sure. A couple of things. Well, so if you think about what allows the greatest excursion of relative movement. So this is segments that can move in opposition, right? It's the ability to create the space that you move into. Okay. So this is a really interesting way to look at things. So if I wanted to internally rotate a shoulder, there has to be a space for me to move into prior to that motion. The cool thing about that is that if we have anterior expansion of the thorax, so the ability to take air into the upper portion of the thorax and expand it forward, that would be the space that I would access to access internal rotation. As you start to access that space starts to disappear. Kind of makes sense. As I move into it, the space actually has to disappear. So that means that the space has to be pre-existing. So when we talk about the foundation of the ability to move the shoulder comfortably with relative motions, it actually has to do with how much air you have in the upper thorax. So it is the foundation of, if you want to call it whatever you want to call it, shoulder range of motion, shoulder mobility, it's like I have to have the capacity to create those spaces. And so the ability to take air into the upper thorax, so the space between your scapulae, the space that's around your sternums, like those two areas are kind of key areas that we have to address to make sure that we can actually make the space to move into in those two areas. And so that affects the scapular position, that affects the relative position of the humerus to the scapula, right? You have superficial musculature that covers those areas that when we move around in certain ways, they can actually compress those areas, limit the amount of air that we get into those spaces. And now we don't even have the space existing to move into. So now we have to use what we call compensatory movement in that circumstance. And so just saying shoulder mobility and then looking at unisolated movement creates a tremendous amount of confusion because I can magnify a measure and not do so with relative motion. So it could seem like, well, this is good motion because it's a lot. I can have a lot of shoulder internal rotation and have none of it actually come from the shoulder joint itself because of the way that we perceive it to occur. I can turn my neck rather aggressively in one direction and it'll look like I have a lot of shoulder internal rotation. And so this is a big error that people make.
Right. And I think,
go ahead. Sure.
I think the cardinal plane thing and the quadrants perspective and the two-dimensional, three-dimensional representations of movement are limiting here because people expect they're dictating their success or their ability to move their shoulder by, can I do this motion? Can I do this lateral motion? Can I reach behind me? And those are the things that they're going to try to stretch or strengthen in hopes that that will fix their problem. When it really is, you boil it down to just the physics of it. When you're talking about trying to create a space and then move into the space, that is really just potential and kinetic energy. That's position preceding kinetic movement, right? When Bill says that, you need to create the space first, making anything up. He's not just coming up with something out of thin air. This is how the physical principles of the universe work.
Yes. So there has to be a space for you to move into. Now, because of the way that we see things, people say, well, there's space all around me. Clearly I can move into that space. But the reality is, when we're talking about being able to move into that space, it's like, well, how are you going to get there? Are you going to get there with relative motions? Are you going to get there with some form of compensatory activity?
Yeah.
And there might be a scenario where either one is appropriate or inevitable.
Yeah.
But we have to differentiate that. We can't just equate the fact that, oh, I can assume this position. It's like, well, how did you get there? Becomes very, very important, especially like in sporting activities and such, because people wonder why like certain things start to hurt. And it's like, well, guess what? Because you didn't get there with this nice distributed force applied through a system. You created an isolated force on a structure to do so.
That I was going to bring up is the structural constraints. You have very hard limits to the spaces that can be created or occupied based on your structure, your skeleton, the rib cage, what's inside the rib cage, the muscles outside of the rib cage restricting the space, the ability to acquire the space. So that's kind of that's the approach we need to take when we're talking about shoulder mobility and hip mobility or any mobility is,
well,
what are those restrictions?
Well, the big step in the right direction is recognizing the fact that the shoulder does not behave in isolation.
Yes.
Right? And so we can go back to our previous example where we're talking about the shape of the hip and the pelvis. And if we can't acquire the pelvis shape that we talked about in the last episode, you're not going to be able to access the internal rotation in the shoulder joint, because the precursor to having expansion in the upper thorax is the ability to create the appropriate pressure in the pelvis itself. Because if I can't do that, I can't keep enough volume up in the thorax to allow me to access the shoulder range of motion in the first place. Because gravity works. And so you will always get squeezed from the top down. And if I don't have a pressure that pushes back up to counter that down force, then again, I have superficial muscle activity that's going to squeeze the thorax. The thorax is going to get smaller, literally smaller. Right? That increases superficial muscle activity that actually restricts the isolated joint ranges of motion. So we lose our relative motions. Now, can you continue to access a position like an internally rotated shoulder? Yes, you can, but you're going to have to use other structures to do it. So when you get that little neck pain there at the right base of your neck, every time you try to internally rotate your shoulder, it's because you don't have the shoulder range of motion to do that activity, and you're actually using another structure to create the position. And that's a problem.
That's a really important precursor to all of this. And it's good that we did hip mobility first, because you refer back to that. That's really, we're talking about step one. I think, step zero would be identifying if there's some type of medical or structural issue that you can't change first. If you've torn something in your shoulder that is severed and it doesn't exist anymore, or you've broken something bone-wise, this conversation doesn't really matter that much. That has to be addressed. But this first step of what position can the hips get in? Can the hips help sort of direct stuff up to get the fluid and the air to expand upwards? Because like you were saying, if the hip position is not controlled and there's an orientation at the hip, say into ER and compression, the fluid is probably going to go forward in a lot of cases and not be able to kind of go upwards and create vertical space.
Well, here's the double whammy. So if we have an anteriorly oriented pelvis, right, that's a substitution for the internal rotation and the position that we talked about in the previous episode. So the shape change that we use to create relative motion, internal rotation, and a high force, high pressure pelvis, well, we have to have a similar representation in the thorax itself. And so if I anteriorly orient the pelvis because I have to push down with some sort of a compensatory strategy, I get bad news. You're going to use the exact same type of strategy in the thorax. And again, now we've duplicated the downforce in that circumstance. Well, that's immediately going to take away the volume in the thorax itself. And so this becomes a problem, because you could actually do an activity that appears to increase a measure, And I say a measure because if you took all of your repeated measures, you would see that the result that you're getting is not the the desired outcome if relative motion is the goal, which means that we're increasing both our ERs and our IRs. What people will tend to do by accident is they will say, I want to change this one measure. I do this one activity and that one measure changes and they go, way to go me, without a recognition of the fact that, well, you actually may have just robbed Peter to pay Paul. You actually took away something that was vital and important regarding relative motion and health to create a magnified measure. And again, I always fall back on the shoulder internal rotation thing because people like to use that as their wow measurement, right?
Right.
Because they go, wow, look at all the internal rotation I got. Well, if I magnified that at the neck, because of the activity that I chose actually magnified an anterior orientation of thorax. So an anterior orientation of thorax increases the next contribution to the shoulder internal rotation measurement.
Okay. Yeah. And
let's write that one down.
And I think that this is something that we've talked about on the network, but I don't think we've talked about it on here yet. But You mentioned a really good point about how people might dictate their success based on a certain measure. Uh-huh. And that measure oftentimes is internal rotation. So it's either with a off the side of the table internal rotation test, but more, I think more importantly or more commonly used is going to be like a scratch test.
Yes.
And it's important for people to know that both reaching over the head and behind the back is both a measurement of IR. And that's something that you've told me recently and you've told people in the network recently that I don't think is common knowledge. It's just assumed that this is an ER test and this is an IR test.
Right.
But they're both, in fact, IR. And when they're do something to improve the scratch test on both sides, I'm going to say, if I don't know any better, oh, I've improved ER and IR by doing this activity. When now you've actually created you've created another issue in order to get some internal rotation back.
Yeah. All you have to do, okay. So somebody reaches up behind their head to reach the opposite shoulder blade, right? Yeah. What's the compensation when they can't do it? They have to jam their, So they have to jam their neck harder into an IR position, not an ER position, but an IR position because they have to create the compensatory action. Right? So they're adding more IR to the system. Therefore, the simple representation here is I'm reaching into an IR space that I do not have available. So I have to create the shape. I have to cheat to get there. Right? So if you do something, and again, it's like people will tend to use that measurement because number one, it's very important and it's a very useful KPI, key performance indicator. Right? But if we look at it in just in isolation, and we don't check everything else, we don't know if the improvement is relative or not, if relative motion is the goal.
Because unfortunately, it's very easy to change and not necessarily in a positive way.
Right.
So it's I can show you that I can get you internal rotation back, but if I anteriorly oriented you in order to do that, it's not going to be a useful long-term strategy.
Well, not from a long-term perspective, you know, certainly from a performance-related perspective, it may be useful, at least for a moment in time. It's like, again, it's like if that becomes the default strategy, there are certain consequences that would be associated with that. And it's typically going to show up as some form of upper thorax thingy or a neck thingy.
Yeah.
Worst case scenario, goes even further up and now you're dealing with mandibular problems. And
for the sake of this conversation today, we're not talking about the high performance needing to lock everything together in one piece to perform at a top level, to throw hard and jump high and run fast. We're talking about reclaiming ranges of motion and we're talking about health and acquiring range of motion and mobility. For lack of a better term, even though we've given so many better terms. This is what people know. Okay. So hip mobility, the ability to acquire a IR shape that will create sort of this almost like a jet nozzle sort of influence of letting stuff flow upwards. That's going to be step one. So I think we get on it, I think this is part of a problem that people have when they do a bunch of activities and their shoulder range of motion gets better in the clinic or at the gym, and then they leave and it goes away immediately. That's because they're probably dealing with a hip and pelvis situation that does not allow them to maintain what they
just this is the problem. Acquired. This is the problem with isolated thinking and thinking like somehow the shoulder is separate from the rest of the system, right?
Sure.
It's like if I didn't address the foundational elements, like I can change shoulder range of motion instantaneously in many different ways, right?
Yeah.
Okay. actually the representation of shoulder range of motion, let's call it that, because the true measure may not have actually changed. Right. But for me to have true access to relative motions, there is a foundational process. So if I'm looking at this from the ground up, it's like for me to have upright capabilities, it's like, okay, gravity works, air gets pushed down all the time inside the system. I got to have a system that can push the air back up into that space. Otherwise I can't. For every degree of overhead reach, you have to be able to push air volume up into the thorax. Because the minute it starts going down the wrong way, it's like your arm actually stops moving. Like you can't do it unless you like arch your back, throw your head back, twist yourself away. And you know, it's like, it just doesn't work.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So I think we've sort of hammered on the fact that
If you're
going after the shoulder mobility thing and you haven't addressed the hips and you haven't watched the previous episode and gotten some idea of what you can do for that, that's where you're going to start.
Yep.
Even though that might not intuitively make sense, where I've got a shoulder issue. I literally just worked with a client right before this where we did a bunch of hip stuff and foam rolling and rolling on the ground and the shoulder range of motion came back. And it was very little to do with anything we did on the foam roller. That's important. It works. So you have to just try to show them that that's going to happen for you. So what's next? We've got the hip position. We've got stuff going up now. What are the things that I need to, what's the interference that I need to get out of the way? And then what do I need to do from a shape change perspective up there?
So depending on the scenario that you saw in the pelvis, you're going to have superficial muscle activity that can limit the shape change of the upper thorax. So we have to be able to reduce that. And thankfully, a lot of times we can just do that with position. So think about being upright, gravity works. So that's a top-down pressure gradient that would be associated with gravity. And in a lot of cases, I can just flop you down on your back, good things happen. Or I put you on your side, good things happen. Because the relative position, I've just altered gravity. It makes it easier for me to put air in certain spaces. So just by position, I can actually favorably influence my capacity to access relative motions in the shoulder. So that would be your next step, so to speak.
Okay. It's going to be finding positional, potentially finding positional breathing activities.
Yes.
Where the focus is on upward and anterior to posterior expansion in the rib cage.
Yeah. So here's the cool thing. And there's the study by Takashima is the lead researcher on this. It's like literally by going from your back to your side, you increase the anterior posterior expansion in the thorax just by doing so. Right. So this is before you superimpose any other activities on top of that. Literally by position, you have the capacity. It doesn't mean it's going to actually happen. It just means that you have the capacity to increase the anterior posterior expansion, which is, again, that area that's around the sternum, that area between the shoulder blades.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
so
that's
actually kind of cool when you think about that. And that's why it's one of the reasons why we use a lot of side-lying activities in the initial stages of rehab is because if we can actually access those positions comfortably, they become very, very powerful for us.
Okay. So we,
because it's easy.
We acquired the hip motion. We're starting to drive fluid and volume up. We're using the ground on our back or on our side to let that propagation of space sort of and volume keep going upwards.
Yes, sir.
There still may be, it's very hard to fill the top of the rib cage just because of gravity and because of structure. There's a very conical shape to the top of the rib cage. So sometimes that may require even more of an inverted position for some.
Yeah. Like hips up, shoulders down kind of a thing.
Yeah. So either.
It's okay. We're adding internal rotation demands here. So it becomes a little bit of a more difficult position. Now we can move our, think about like going, being on all fours, drop down to your elbows, kind of a position, right?
Yeah.
As a frame of reference.
And starting wider.
We can make it a little bit easier by starting into a wider position. So that adds some of the external rotation. So that gives us potential space. Right, to land the internal rotation. So if I don't even have full shoulder internal rotation, I can still potentially use that position because the internal rotation demands are reduced. And so it will allow me to invert and makes it easier because I flip-flop gravity. So now the bottom of the lung is actually what we would consider the top of the lung if we were upright. And so then again, gravity gives us like this little assist as far as when the air flows into the lung, where's it going to go first? Well, it can't go up as easily as it would go down. Down is now the top of the thorax. So that's useful.
So let's say So last time we talked about using the side lying step, the foam roller step over I hate to say catch all, but sort of big bang for your buck.
It is mobility. It is useful for sure. Yeah.
We wanted to try to use an activity as a comparison, but I believe a common misconception is that, well, I can just take the foam roller and jam it under my arm. And roll over the foam roller in the same way that I did with the pelvis, and I'll do the same thing. So let's have people reconsider that first and why that doesn't work that way.
It's a great name for a podcast. number one, if we were to look at an analog for, so we use the ilium in the pelvis as our target for the foam roller, we would not be able to access the analog in the shoulder. So attempting to do what appears to be the same thing, you're not in the same location. Okay. Now, doesn't make it not useful, just means you're not going to be doing the same thing, right? And so when you think about the ability to access certain positions implies the access to space. So if I need to assume a quadruped position, I have to have expansion in the anterior thorax to actually put my extremity in that position without a compensation, right? But I also have to move my humerus away from the scapula. And so that would be internal rotation. When you apply the contact up into the axilla, you're in most situations reducing the muscle activity between the scapula and the humerus, which would allow you to position the scapula in the position that we need to access internal rotation. Right. So we're changing the muscle activity in that circumstance, whereas in the pelvis, we were literally promoting a shape change within the pelvis with the muscle activity following. In this case, we're reducing muscle activity, and then we're gonna promote the ability to make the shape change, which is scapular position and humeral position.
Okay. And so to clarify also, the shape change that I am actually achieving in the rib cage on the roller would be one of compensatory internal rotation I have to bend over the
roller. If you were on the rib cage, if you were actually on the rib cage in that scenario, you're going to create a compensatory IR because you're going to create a compression in that area, right? Not an expansion. So we would want an expanded representation to actually access the relative motions. Well, I can push on that area. And I can magnify a shoulder measure, not the relative motion in the shoulder, but I can make a shoulder measure look better because the motion is going to come most likely from cervical spine in this circumstance.
Right.
Because like I said, you're compressing the area you're trying to expand. So again, wrong strategy, and then not attending to your measures to actually determine what is happening. And again, this is the problem of using a singular measurement as your guiding process.
And the other thing I wanted to mention before moving on is the conical shape that we were talking about of the apex of the rib cage or the top of the rib cage. Mm-hmm. If I was to push on that laterally, I'm actually going to shove volume away from the cone down again.
Down. Yes.
So what you are potentially doing there, it's not a good analogy to draw between the shape change of the pelvis with what we did last time versus you doing this step over, rolling over the foam roller thing. Uh-huh. You are potentially getting a lowering of muscle activity that will allow you to move the humerus and scapula, I guess, independently of one another or away from each other.
Yeah. So it's relative. It's like you're literally restoring the relative motion that should be available. That promotes the shape change. That's actually what allows the expanded representation of thorax to be maintained, assuming we have the bottom up pressure. Yeah.
So not necessarily a bad activity. Just know what you're doing and use
it
for.
Yes. Don't make the assumption that it looks the same. Therefore, it's the same.
Right. So in a better analogy to another, a better activity to use that would be more analogous to the step over on a roller would be rolling on the ground, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So let's talk a bit about that. Uh-huh. I'll let you talk about that.
So if you think about starting in your back and then like rolling to one side,
Yeah.
Right. So you have a ground contact that is actually on the scapula itself. So now we're actually getting closer to an analogous representation of the step over activity, because we're actually going to put some pressure in the right space. But here's the cool thing. So as you would ground a scapula and you're rolling from supine to one side, the scapula actually starts moving slower than the thorax. And so now actually the thorax can get ahead. And now we're actually going to create a space between the ground contact and the spine. Well, that would certainly be favorable to allow us to create this anterior posterior expansion of the rib cage, which is why there are certain activities that will actually use the grounded scapula as a targeted ground contact because of the benefits that are associated with having it on the ground, because then everything can move relative to that, right? So anytime we use a ground contact, whether it's a foot or a knee or an elbow or a hand or whatever it might be, we're going to try to move relative to that. So this gives us benefit.
Would my ultimate display of this be a more of a longitudinal roll?
On the long axis?
Yeah, so a log roll style.
In something that falls into that category, like we can still roll on helices, right?
I want to give people some activities to strive towards. So maybe it would be better to let's take a step back and think about what are the most common deficiencies or what's the lowest common denominator, how you might need to transition someone slowly to get to be able to do a long axis roll. Where would I want to start? So maybe like an arm bar and then doing more of a delayed roll and then doing a, you know what I mean? Okay. What would a progression be?
Well, so, okay. Let's take a position like hook line to start.
Sure. Cause so we managed the hip stuff first, just as another, I'm just harping back to this again. We did the hip stuff. That's all taken care of. I've acquired a good enough position and I've gotten rid of anterior orientation so that I can start in hook line.
Yes, sir.
That's where I started for. Okay, yeah. Now we'll go.
Yeah, so if I was to drive one side of the pelvis away from the ground, one side of the thorax away from the ground, and then ground the opposite side, that would be the same sequence as initiating a roll away from the so-called reaching side, right? And so I could actually perform that as the initial activity, because what that's going to provide is the ground contacts that I need for relative motions as I move across the ground.
Okay.
So here's what I don't want to do. Here would be like a general mistake. I would never pull my scapulae together posterior and try to flatten them into the ground. That would actually promote the forward motion of the thorax that we've tried to eliminate. So I want to make sure that the space between the spine and the scapula exists. And so initiating by pushing one side of the body forward relative to the other while you're grounded increases the grounding effect on the downside.
Right.
That's what I would need to initiate a roll in whichever direction I'm going. That would be the grounded side.
So what that might look like for those listening on their Spotify instead of watching us would be someone being in hook lying, maybe their arms are in almost a goblet position in front of their body and they are pushing through their foot to roll onto their left SI joint, their left scapula, and then back to the center.
And you could literally just drive a reach across with the other arm. Like you don't have to keep the arm tucked in.
The elbow could reach. The only thing I worry about is when people reach with their straight arm, they anteriorly orient very hard.
True. No, I get that. I get that.
Yeah.
But my point is, it's like you can encourage that movement to improve the ability to ground the downside.
Yeah, so that's like a hook line reach and roll. I think we have a video of that. I'll put that up.
Yeah.
So that's step one. We're starting the turn. We're starting to ground the scapula to allow us to start that turn into what would eventually become a roll. So what would be my next activity?
So thinking about the abilities to sort of step over from the backside, right? So once you've acquired the requisite pelvis position, you should have enough internal rotation in the lower extremity to allow you to straighten the lower extremity and then step over. And so now we're actually rolling through the pelvis very similarly to what we did on the foam roller. Now we don't have the foam roller this time, but we can initiate the roll from the bottom up, which is actually going to be helpful in this circumstance, because what it's going to do is it's going to start to push volume in the superior direction as we roll across. So again, this becomes favorable. So we're pushing volume upward into the upper thorax as we're rolling toward the one side.
And this would be a delayed roll.
Actually, if we're going to go from supine to side lying, it's going to be initiated very similar to like your armbar activities.
First. Okay, so, and that would be, it's almost like the delayed roll in reverse.
Yeah, but again, because we're not sort of reverse engineering the turn here, I would hesitate to make.
Well,
that
what do you want to
you're
call
delaying
it,
the, you're always delaying the downside in that circumstance. Like you're advancing one side over.
Yeah.
Right. So it's just like a step. It's like taking a step.
Okay. So we started to rock and reach and roll and hook lying, and then we've started to step over in like an arm bar type of fashion. And now we've stepped over. Is that it? Is that all we need to start doing a lower body?
Potentially,
long axis roll.
Yeah. So potentially, yes. So if you look at like the middle position of the armbar, now we're in our side lying position. So there's a lot of internal rotation that's associated with this. A lot of anterior posterior expansion in the thorax is going to be driven by this position as well.
Okay. So is that it? Have we acquired our shoulder mobility back with all of these movements?
Well, it depends on how far we're interested in going here, right?
Yeah.
So our earliest propulsive measures in the shoulder are above shoulder level, right? So we would want to get the downside arm into a position that's actually across the face. So we're going to have to roll a little bit further in that circumstance. And again, this is where your arm bars and finishing the rolling behaviors in this circumstance can be helpful in that regard as far as getting arm above shoulder level.
Yeah. Okay. So that is the ultimate goal, is to be able to have my arms overhead, have a lower body initiated roll that I can perform all the way up. So I'm not driving with a hard muscular reaching and squeezing of my upper body. I'm using the lower body to kind of push toothpaste up to the top of the toothpaste tube.
Yeah.
And I'm letting my upper body go along for the ride.
Yes.
And eventually I need to be able to do both, right? I need to be able to roll with the lower body initiated and an upper body initiated so that I can retain the expansion from front to back while also driving compression from the top down. Those are going to be the people that can leave the clinic or the gym and hang on to their mobility.
So think about initially, we want to make sure that we can capture the relative motions. And then secondly, there's the princess. Then secondly, we want to be able to drive this top down and then still be able to access the relative motions.
Okay. All right. So we've got the hip stuff managed. We'll check out the last podcast if you need to learn more about that. Someone can nail a step over on a foam roller and they can create that IR shape to get stuff to go up. Then we've used the foam roller to kind of manage muscle activity. And we've used positional breathing in order to promote the air flowing upwards into the rib cage. And we've talked also about inverting the person as well to help
use gravity
gravity to try to get them to the top of the expansion of the rib cage.
Yeah.
Then we start the rolling. If we have a stepwise progression, we start the rolling from a position of hook lying, and we start to roll ourselves from side to side and start to initiate that turn to the side. Yes. We continue the turn with a stepping over activity that would be similar to doing an arm bar. And then once we have that, you can start. Is that where I might use a delayed roll after I have that in order to have another step in between long axis roll?
This is going to depend on a couple of measures. So the advantage of like a delayed roll is it's going to eliminate, let's just say that I drove a compensatory strategy, like a compensatory IR is basically what you're going to, you'll see a magnification of early hip IR or early shoulder IR that you don't want.
Challenging question for some, not for you necessarily,
okay.
But what am I going to see? What am I going to see in their motion when they're trying to do the armbar action? What is it I can see that they can't do?
Well, the end result is going to be a reduction in hip external rotation or shoulder rotation and then a magnification of shoulder internal rotation, hip internal rotation. So your IRs get bigger and your ERs get smaller, relatively speaking. That would be that's indicative of a compensatory strategy to actually produce this roll. What the delayed roll does is it slows the spine motion down, that you would have been using as the compensatory strategy. And that's typically okay. when you would use this I had a spine that went faster than the pelvis did, basically is what happened. And so I need to slow the spine down. So we use the delayed roll in that circumstance. And you might want to, I don't know if you want to throw that up here on the screen.
Yeah, I will. I'm going to try to put an example of most of these things we're talking about. My question was more if at some point in the sequence of the hook lying rolling to the step over armbar maneuver to like the long axis rolling, what am I going to see them doing in those activities that would be that substitution? And for instance, am I going to see a knee that's going away from midline towards their shoulder versus towards the...
Okay, so you ask somebody to step over in the roll.
Yeah.
Okay. And they can't bring the knee past 90 degrees of hip bend.
Okay.
Dead giveaway.
Yeah.
Dead giveaway. They can't bring. So when you think about cueing and such for like a hip position, we always want to guide people towards midline. Right. And so what you'll see is you'll see an acceleration of the knee crossing midline as they're initiating the roll. So it goes very, very quickly across midline.
Okay.
And then you see like a big lower back kind of leading the roll versus the hip leading the roll.
It's like they're swinging their lower body through the center instead of being able to control it.
There's a big acceleration actually that would go across. Yeah.
Okay.
You would see that for sure.
All right.
Yeah.
So I think we've laid out some activities and trying to get someone to be able to do the long axis rolling with the lower body lead and the upper body lead. What people had given us some suggestions on things to ask. Dale had a good one, but I can't remember what it was for what we should talk about at the end of the podcast here.
For the people that survived all the way through.
Yeah. For those, for the real ones that stick around to the end. And what was the... Dale, I thought we talked about this. Dale said favorite MTV music video from back in the MTV days.
Oh, man.
I can think of some of the first ones that I think Aha, Take On Me was probably one of the first ones that I remember.
Oh, that got played every
constantly.
So I had mono in high school.
And the kissing disease, Bill.
Yes, I know. I gave it to my then girlfriend as well. So there you go.
Nice.
So I memorized the rotation on MTV.
Okay.
Because Rat had just come out with Round and Round.
Oh, yeah.
I love that song. And so, yeah, so I memorized that. So Rat was one that kind of stood out early on. But that was like 1984.
Man, I remember heavy rotations of Michael Jackson, Beat It, Bad. Yeah.
Yeah. When Thriller came out, they had that
Thriller
like movie.
Oh, yeah. That gave me nightmares for years.
Yes.
Scared me for years.
Okay. Yeah, I think Rat would be like the one that stands out the most.
Yeah, biggest one for me is... What was the Money for Nothing and Chicks for Free? What's the one that was like...
Oh, Dire Straits?
Yeah, Dire Straits.
Dire Straits.
That was like... That's when they first... That's the first song I can remember talking about MTV.
Yeah.
It was designed for the music video release of music videos, basically.
Like Hall & Oates had a bunch of videos.
Oh, yeah.
So here you go. Here's the thing that stands out when you think about this. It's like they were so strapped for videos early on. This is where a lot of the English bands that were total unknowns and one-hit wonders.
Yeah, they came on, yeah.
That became famous because of MTV, because they had the one song.
Devo, you think like Devo got to be famous because of MTV? Because of like...
Oh, there's no question about that.
They had those really colorful and kooky...
I think Whip It might have been the number one song of that year.
Yeah.
Because of that. That's kind of weird.
with the construction, the red
they
cone
still,
hat thing.
I just saw an article that guy, the lead singer, is still out there wearing the head thingy doing
nice.
Yeah.
All right. Well, post the memorable music videos from MTV that you got. All right. See you later.